Last time we spoke about the Allied drive to Munda and General Sasaki's major counteroffensive. General Wing began the drive upon Munda Point, but General Sasaki predicted many of the routes the Americans would take and ordered his forces to create tedious roadblocks and defensive positions to foil their advances. The Allied progress was brutally slow, despite having an enormous advantage in artillery, naval, and aerial bombardment support. The Japanese pillboxes were proving to be devastating to the Allied infantry, requiring tanks to be brought over to New Georgia. When things began to halt, suddenly General Sasaki performed a counteroffensive, seeing a daring attack directed at the headquarters of the 43rd Division. The attack nearly broke the lines of communication, but luckily the Fijian commandos outperformed the Japanese at their own game of night fighting. Lastly, the IJN suffered terrible losses to the Allied aircraft, collapsing their reinforcement efforts. This episode is the Mysterious Battle of the Pips. Welcome back to the Pacific War Podcast week by week, and I'm your dutiful host, Craig Watson. But before we can begin, I just want to remind you all, this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals has an assortment of episodes on World War II and so much more, so go give them a look over at YouTube. So please, subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that you are still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel over at YouTube. Are you in the mood for something different? Check out my humorous episode on Zhang Zongchang, the monster behind the meme. He also famously went by the name Dog Meat General, probably the largest history meme on the internet. His story was fascinating, but it was also extremely dark. And just a friendly reminder, I myself have a Patreon account, which can be found at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel. The next exclusive podcast over there is going to be about Emperor Hirohito's role during World War II. How involved was he, actually? So please check all of that out. It would mean a lot to me. The battles in New Guinea and New Georgia were particularly bloody. In all honesty, things had begun to really escalate when you look at it from a numerical point of view. Over on Green Hill, General Savage had just seized Mubo, the Pimple, Green Hill, and Observation Hill, taking them out of Japanese hands. The Japanese had withdrawn to Comantium, while simultaneously trying to defend Bobdivy Ridge against Brigadier Hammer's 15th Brigade. General Savage, who I should be calling General Savage, but I'm going to continue to call him Savage because I think it's cool, is still unaware Salama was not the main target and in fact was being used as a deception to cover for Ley. So he was continuing his offensive, hoping to drive the enemy north of the Francisco River. Over on the other side, General Nakano's 1st Battalion of the 80th Regiment had managed to push Companies B and A off their ambush position on the bench track. They were being forced to withdraw towards Guiboan by July the 10th. Meanwhile, to the south, Major Worf launched an attack along Goodview Junction. Captain Wally Mears of C Platoon marched up Stevens Track, while Captain John Winterflood's B Platoon took Walpole's Track. Lieutenant Hugh Egan created a blocking position using just 7 men around 800 meters south of Goodview Junction. The platoons went to work, advancing down the steep ridges, dislodging Japanese from their outposts. Captain Mears' platoon were continuing along Stevens Track when they suddenly encountered strong resistance from some Japanese who took a position along the Tambu Saddle, which is a junction between Stevens Track and the Mule Track. After engaging the Japanese, the platoon was forced to bypass them by moving along the Mule Track towards Comantium's Track, where they ran into some more Japanese. Mears and his men killed 13 Japanese on the Mule Track before deciding to withdraw back to Stevens Track, and then they had to dig in. The Japanese had surprised Worf's men. The forces they were running into were mainly the 1st and 2nd companies of the 66th Battalion, along with Atake's HQ staff who had been on the run from Mubo to Comantium. The Japanese tried to press on with a counterattack aimed at Winterflood's B platoon. The Japanese tossed mortar and machine gun fire, but received terrible losses to their commandos, forcing them to pull back up the Walpole Track. The next day, Worf ordered Winterflood's platoon to make a frontal assault, but quickly found themselves pinned down by machine gun fire and during the night received a heavy counterattack that forced them again to dig in. The Japanese continued to block the way, covering their withdrawal further east, but all of the mayhem prompted General Savage to relieve the commandos by tossing up Companies C and B of the 2 and 5th, who adopted the name Bennett Force, as they were being led by Captain Cam Bennett. The rest of the 2 and 5th marched up the Big Gap. Meanwhile, General Herring was dealing with a supply issue for the 3rd Australian Division. The 3rd Division was too far from the coast, and they had been relying on supplies via airdrops, which, as we've seen during this series, is not particularly accurate nor quite adequate. The supply problems mounted more when the decision was made to target Leh, and as such, the campaign now required building up reserve dumps. Worf's men were critically low on supplies. The 58th, 59th had nearly used up all of the supplies they received, being brought up via the Missim track, and from airdrops, of course. Getting further and further away from the source of supplies, and with declining carrier capacity, Worf's men were reaching starvation point. Further back, Companies A and C of the 2 and 6th Battalion got drafted the job of moving the supplies from Mubo to the Big Gap Creek. General Herring considered it extremely difficult, but not impossible, to maintain further units in the Salamaua area, if they were closer to the coast. To solve the problem, General Herring designated Tambu Bay as a new coastal base for supplies. It would also help as an artillery position. And thus, the 3rd Battalion 162nd Regiment of Major Archibald Roosevelt landed at Nassau Bay back on July the 12th, commencing with their coastal advance. They were accompanied by Brigadier General Ralph Cone's artillery. They had landed just prior to them. Yet, their advance would begin in an extremely confused and chaotic manner. The question of command was at the core of the issue. General Fuller had decided to separate units, such as Archibald Roosevelt's, from the McKechnie force, and thus they were now placed under the command of the Cohen force. General Herring was forced to intervene, placing the Cohen force under General Savage. But at the same time, Colonel McKechnie was relieved of his command because Fuller felt that he had favored the Australians over the Americans. To dig a bit deeper into this mess, what really occurred was General Savage and Colonel McKechnie were both unaware that two-thirds of the 162nd Regiment had been allocated to the Cohen Force when General Herring had sent a very confusing message to try and clarify things. All units, MAC Force, are under operational control of 3rd Australian Division. Troubles soon began as Mouton ordered Major Roosevelt to advance north. But Roosevelt had been told by General Fuller that he was not under Australian command. Thus, Roosevelt bluntly replied to Mouton, "For your information, I obey no orders except those from my immediate superior." Then McKechnie tried to smooth things over with Mouton when he was informed of Fuller's position. He apologized for Roosevelt's message, and he tried to speak about how great all the Australian-American cooperation was going. Fuller and Herring then tried to clarify the situation by placing the Cohen force under General Savage. But Fuller also decided to dismiss McKechnie, mostly because he had relinquished command of his men to the Australians, and thus had failed to protect American interests. As I say on my personal channel, not that often, mind you, particularly about China's warlord era and the role of certain generals on the battlefield, this is some kindergarten bullshit. Back to the action at hand, the Cohen force was being aided by a Papuan company who were scouting ahead of the Americans. They managed to confirm that Tambu Bay and the Dot Inlet were occupied and fortified by the Japanese. A platoon of the 5th Sasebo SNLF and the 3rd Battalion 66th Regiment were holding a position on Tambu Bay, while the remnants of the 3rd Battalion 102nd Regiment were on a ridge overlooking the bay, which would later be named Roosevelt Ridge. On July the 18th, Roosevelt led the troops with Companies L and I taking the lead, guided by two Papuan platoons. L Company, with a Papuan company, advanced along an inland track, while K Company likewise did so along the coast. K Company's Papuan guides hit a Japanese outpost south of Boise on July the 18th. On the morning of the 20th, the Papuan platoon managed to kill four Japanese before K Company helped destroy the outpost. By the 20th, they seized Boise and Roosevelt with the others approached Tambu Bay. Roosevelt was aided by Cohen's artillery. They brought up four 25-pounders and the 2-6 Australian Field Regiment originally placed at Nassau Bay, along with two batteries of the 218th American Field Artillery Battalion, eight 75mm guns from North Salis, a battery of the 205th American Field Artillery Battalion, and four 105mm guns. Under the cover of the artillery, they attacked the enemy, but they were met with heavy mortar fire coming from Roosevelt Ridge. Roosevelt Ridge extended westwards from the sea for nearly 2,000 yards, forming kind of a bulwark that shielded the northern end of Tambu Bay. Thus, Tambu Bay could not be secured unless the ridge was taken first. The Australian Broadcasting Commission correspondent Peter Hemery described the ridge as such: a piece of old-style razor blade jutting into the sea. According to some Japanese sources, they had this to say about it: the area around Bosie had a lay of land most suitable to the arrest of the enemy advancing northward along the coast. General Nakano had decided to reinforce the ridge with 250 men of the 1st Battalion, 115th Regiment, but of course this also came at the cost of Salamaua's defense. By this point, the bulk of the 102nd Regiment was at the Malolo Bang coastal area, and the bulk of the 115th Regiment and the 2nd Mazuro SNLF, two companies of the 5th Sasebo SNLF, and the 14th Field Artillery Regiment were at Salamaua, around 150 men in total. Over on the other side, after the fall of Mubo, Brigadier Moton had the men advance north. The Bennett force took over Goodview Junction. Companies A and D of the 2 and 5th advanced to Mount Tambu. Now, Mount Tambu was the highest feature along the route between Mubo and Salamaua. It consisted of a series of razorback ridges covered in a dense jungle, ideal for camouflaging pillboxes. Its area was defended by roughly 700 Japanese from the 2nd and 3rd Battalions of the 66th Regiment, led by Lieutenant Colonel Fukuzo Kimura and Major Sakai Sugiyama. On July the 16th, Captain Mick Walter led 16 men of Company A up the steep track leading to the south crest of Mount Tambu. Walter led the men to storm the two forward knolls, taking the Japanese by complete surprise. The two knolls were captured, but during the night the Japanese counterattacked in force. The Japanese crawled up the knolls through some heavy undergrowth before they unleashed mortars and mountain gun fire. Walter's men, however, had captured some Japanese pillboxes upon taking the two knolls, and thus they turned the tables on them. Eight consecutive counterattacks were tossed at Walter's men, each repulsed with heavy losses, around 39 casualties for the Australians and 350 for the Japanese. The following day, D Company came up to help the Australian defenders, bringing much-needed mortars. They dug in on a knoll around 300 yards back on the track. Alongside D Company also came much-needed supplies and additional platoons to reinforce his men that he had deployed on his western flank. On July the 18th, Walter ordered an advance, going northwest in an attempt to secure the southern portion of Mount Tambu. The advance was spearheaded by Lance Corporal Jackson, who alongside his comrades tossed grenades into Japanese pillboxes. Jackson then stormed inside, killing three Japanese with his Tommy gun. Alongside Jackson, mortar and mountain gun fire aided Walter's men to gain 80 additional yards, securing the southern portion of Mount Tambu. They could advance no further, however, as it became much more difficult from this position as the Japanese basically were encircling them upon Razorback Ridge to their north. Walter would write later on, "We dug in on the new ground and shortened our perimeter to the narrowing plateau." For this action, the Australians paid with 6 lives, 13 wounded, while the Japanese lost 82. At this point, Walter had D Company with one of his platoons holding the western flank. A Company held the northern knoll, and two platoons from D Company held the eastern knolls. The Japanese had been devastated, losing hundreds of men, and Allied artillery was becoming a nightmare. Captain Newman's C Company of the 162nd Battalion had come up the junction of Bui Gap and Bui O. From there, a reconnaissance patrol found suitable artillery positions northwest of the junction. With the help of some native carriers and 80 men of the 2-6 Battalion, two guns were hauled over the Bui Gap track, and by July the 17th, another four guns of the Americans' 218th Battalion were hauled up from a southern arm of the Bitoy River to Green Hill. From these positions, the Allies could smash multiple Japanese defensive positions. General Nakano realized Mount Tambu was an essential component of General Maruya's defensive line, so he sent the remainder of the 3rd Battalion, 66th Regiment to reinforce Colonel Araki's men. Then, during the early hours of July the 19th, a large earth tremor startled the Australian defenders. It was a prelude to an assault led by Captain Kunizo Hatsugai's 9th Company of the 66th Regiment. They had crept up silently, managing to get behind the southern knolls, then suddenly charged up under the cover of darkness. But the defenders had their guard up, and they were not taken by surprise. A Bren gunner managed to knock out one of the Japanese raiders' machine guns with a lucky hit in the dark. As the Japanese scrambled to try and recover it, they were met with fire, causing severe casualties. The Japanese surprise attack was a complete failure, forcing them to withdraw by first light, leaving 21 dead across the knoll. While this raid was occurring, Walter's men were also repelling a series of attacks against the northern knoll. During these attacks, Walter was injured. But luckily for Walter and his company, they were relieved on the 19th by D Company. Another American unit, C Company of the 1st Battalion, 162nd Regiment, led by Captain Delmar Newman, also arrived to take up a position on the southern knolls. Until July the 23rd, the Australians had limited their actions to just patrols. And on the 20th, Bennett led a patrol making contact with a strong Japanese position on the Walpole track. Another company led by Morris found a Japanese position in the Goodview area, dug within 100 yards of their own. Meanwhile, the Japanese also limited their actions to just a few patrols prodding Mount Tambu for weaknesses. On July the 23rd, Mohn ordered the 2 and 5th Battalion to attack the remaining Japanese positions on the Tambu Knoll, but it was the most heavily fortified yet. Basically, it was like a castle keep, complete with a ravine for a moat, near vertical walls and deep tunnels going through the knoll. Mount Tambu's peak held 10 logs worth of reinforced bunkers connected by tunnels which could shelter half a battalion or so. They also had a chain of weapon pits set up on the lower ledges. Later on, when investigating the entire system, the Allies would find weapon pits to be around 4 logs thick, interconnected by crawl trenches. Many of these weapon pits had been carefully sited within the roots of very large trees, making them impervious to Allied artillery fire. The tunnel entrances were dug into the side of the peak directly behind the defensive positions, allowing the defenders to storm out from their shelters underground within mere seconds. It was these kind of ingenious defensive works that would be built upon later in the war to create absolute nightmares for the Allies on other islands. Obviously, if anyone's seen a few Pacific War movies, think Iwo Jima. Mohn had not carried out a thorough reconnaissance of the Japanese positions prior to ordering the attack, and thus many of his subordinates elected to make a frontal assault instead of encircling them. D Company took the center for the frontal attack, while the left were covered by the 16th Platoon led by Sergeant Alvin Hungry Williams and the 18th Platoon led by Lieutenant Bernard Lennitz. A Company advanced along Caffin's track heading for the western flank of Mount Tambu to try and cut off the main Japanese supply route going back to Comantium. 15 minutes before they charged, Australian and American artillery and mortars fired upon Mount Tambu. 2 Australian mountain guns fired 90 rounds while the 4 75mm American guns fired 60 per gun from Green Hill. D Company began their attack around midday, trying to drive a wedge between the 2 lines of pillboxes. Corporal John Smith laid cover fire as Captain Lynn Cameron crept forward, getting within 15 yards of the pillboxes on the left side of the track. Cameron counted around 7 pillboxes in 2 lines of defense, going across both sides of the track. The steep slopes on both sides gave little venues of approach, allowing just a platoon at a time. There was also sharpened bamboo pickets on the left flank, leading Cameron to believe that an attack was expected there. The Japanese knowingly had let 2 platoons reach their line of forward pillboxes before unleashing hell upon them. The casualties were terrible, as Cameron recounted. "We were within 20 meters of the enemy bunkers before all hell let loose." One of the men in the forward sections was killed outright. Cameron was wounded, his right elbow was shattered by a machine gun bullet. As he saw his men hesitate, he screamed out, "Forward! Get stuck into them!" With his right arm now useless and his eyesight dimming, Cameron handed command over to Lieutenant Martin. Despite the horror, the Australians pressed on. Corporal Carey led his depleted platoon forward in a great dash, and he swept the outer ring of the Japanese pillboxes. Over to his left were Leonard's men, who had stormed two pillboxes before heavy enfilade fire pinned them down. Then the 17th platoon, led by Corporal John Smith, charged up Mount Tambu from behind with their bayonets fixed. Smith screamed out, "Follow me," as he charged. 3 men out of 11 managed to keep up with Smith, but soon Japanese grenades began to rain down upon them. The grenades caught them just as they had passed a third line of pillboxes. Smith was hit, but he kept charging, and when he reached the peak of Mount Tambu with his back to the enemy, he screamed out, "Come on, boys! Come on, boys!" Without additional support and with no indication A Company were even making any progress over on the left flank, the 4 men on the peak were forced to withdraw. The gallant Smith had to be dragged down, and he would die from severe wounds 2 days later. Smith was decorated for bravery in Syria in 1941, when he cleared out 3 machine gun nests at a roadblock, and despite being wounded during the Battle of Wau, he still had gas left in the tank for some more. Scouts had made their way towards the Tambu Saddle Track and spotted Japanese soldiers, around 125 of them, a full company or so. The scouts quickly realized they were outnumbered. Thus, when the artillery began to open up and Walter's company moved in for the attack across the saddle, no sooner than they started, the enemy halted them in their tracks. Walter had no choice but to withdraw around 500 yards southeast, as the Japanese were simply too strong. Walter's inability to make progress in the west ultimately ruined the entire attack. Despite the defeat, companies A and D had done quite well against a heavily fortified position. Meanwhile, Worf and his men were marching when they discovered Ambush Knoll had come back under the hands of some Japanese from the 2nd Battalion, 66th Regiment. On July the 15th, Worf's commandos launched an attack, with C Platoon performing a frontal assault along the narrow ridge top track. There were 16 men in the attack, and they found themselves face to face with well-dug-in Japanese. The Japanese were behind a bamboo barricade with some pillboxes scattered about. The platoon got within 50 feet of the main barricade, but Japanese fire was simply too much and the casualties were mounting quickly. Meanwhile, B Platoon was maneuvering around the Japanese eastern flank. At 5:30, B Platoon began attacking the eastern side of the knoll. The men got behind an enemy pillbox covering the track from Orodubi, but the Japanese quickly saw the Australians and began tossing grenades at them. Despite their resistance, B Platoon managed to cut off the Japanese supply line to Ambush Knoll. With their supply lines cut, the Japanese were forced to withdraw. With Ambush Knoll back under Allied control, Brigadier Hammer ordered A Company of the 58th 59th Battalion to depart Guebolam and to attack Orodubi from its southern flank. Even with the help of the 58th 59th Company, the commandos yet again failed to dislodge the Japanese. On the night of July the 19th, fresh troops from the 1st Company, 80th Battalion, used the light of a full moon to come up the ridge. This became a staging point for them to attack Ambush Knoll, seeing artillery fire beginning in the morning to support said attack. Worf's commandos were manning the trenches on Ambush Knoll, turning the tables back on the Japanese and inflicting heavy casualties upon them. The Japanese were forced to retreat yet again. The next day, Worf reinforced Ambush Knoll with 2 Vickers guns, which gave the Japanese a nasty surprise when they attacked again. On the 20th, the Japanese opened fire with mortars and artillery before charging the ridge. They managed to get as far as to cut the Australian lines of communication, but were ultimately repelled once again. Over 14 consecutive attacks would be made on the 20th, and even more so on the 21st, but it all came to nothing. Worf's commandos held their ground. Facing such pressure from the Japanese, Hammer still felt the greater weight of their attention was directed at Bob Dubi, and not towards Tambu, believing it all to be a consequence of Moton's lack of progress. General Savage decided to order Moton's 2 and 6 Battalion to take responsibility over Bob Dubi Ridge. The 2 and 6 then came across the Japanese rear near the slopes of Ambush Knoll, and they began harassing them. On the 22nd, the Japanese tried yet again to attack Ambush Knoll, but they were beaten back firmly, forcing them to finally withdraw to Sugarcane Ridge. By July the 23rd, Worf's exhausted commandos earned some relief by the 2 and 6, and they were sent to relieve A Company at Guebolam, while A Company advanced north. The 2 and 6 likewise would advance north. But now we are going to have to move away from the troubles of New Guinea as we are heading back up to the frigid Aleutians. After the successful seizure of Attu, Admiral Kincaid and General Buckner needed to plan an invasion of Kiska. Kiska was the last Japanese bulwark in the Aleutian Islands, and it held an incredible underground city. There were miles of tunnels, buried ammunition dumps, barracks, 3 hospitals, dental clinics, mess halls, machine shops, warehouses, photo labs, telephone rooms, all shoved and stored with wood. Ventilation pipes connected the maze of caves and tunnels, with Japanese troops wearing great fur-lined coats busy at work. The Americans had experienced hell on Attu. Over 2,872 Japanese had been killed or committed suicide. Just 28 men were captured, and it cost 549 American lives, 1,148 wounded, and nearly another 2,000 ill or battered by the harsh climate. The American leadership expected Kiska to be another hellscape, and they did not want to come at it lightly. The 7th Division, led by Brigadier General Archibald Arnold, Buckner's 4th Regiment, the 87th Mountain Infantry Regiment, the 13th Canadian Brigade, consisting of the 6th Canadian Division led by Major General George Perks, the Canadian Fusiliers Regiment, the 1st Battalion of the Winnipeg Grenadiers, the Rocky Mountain Rangers Regiment, the Regiment du Hull, along with the 1st Special Service Force led by Colonel Robert Frederick, were to be part of the invasion of Kiska, codenamed Operation Cottage. Unfortunately, the actual invasion will not be happening in this episode. You will actually have to wait some few weeks for that one. But I just so happen to have recently done a podcast with a Canadian military historian named Brad St. Croix from the YouTube channel OTD Military History. You might remember him. He was the same gentleman I interviewed quite a long time ago for the Battle of Hong Kong. Well, the podcast I did with Brad this time was on the Canadian experience of the Pacific War. And the Battle of Kiska is about 1/3 of it. So if you are impatient, let's say, and you want to learn some neat stuff about how the Canadians had to change their entire military organization and use American equipment for the Battle of Kiska, please go over to my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel, over on YouTube and check it out. Now, the last time we spoke about Kiska, the Japanese were forced to perform a bit of a miracle to evacuate their boys. After Attu had fallen, Rear Admiral Akiyama Manzo, alongside 6,000 men, were ordered to evacuate Kiska. To try and do this, the Japanese began by sending 13 I-class submarines of the 1st Submarine Squadron, led by Rear Admiral Koda Takio. Despite these Type C submarines being enormous in size, they could only carry around 150 men per trip. Thus, it would take 40 successful journeys to evacuate the entire Kiska garrison. With the United States Navy fully decked out with sonar, this was not going to be a walk in the park. The efforts had begun on May the 27th, and by July, the submarines had managed to get 800 men safely back to Japan, but they had lost 300 due to American attacks. Meanwhile, Admiral Giffen had a considerable armada to work with, consisting of a trio of older battleships, the Mississippi, Idaho, and New Mexico, a quintet of cruisers, Louisville, Portland, San Francisco, Santa Fe, and Wichita, and 9 destroyers. He was ordered to bombard Kiska, who had already been smashed with aerial attacks all throughout June and early July. On July the 6th, Giffen steamed towards Kiska with 4 cruisers and 4 destroyers and bombarded the island for 22 minutes, causing a handful of casualties. It was not all that impressive, but it convinced Admiral Kawase that the Americans were about to invade Kiska at any moment. Admiral Kawase Shino realized the futility of the submarine effort, and he was forced to come up with a new plan. Kawase came up with a bold plan. He was going to wait for a night when there was a thick fog occurring, and he would take a surface fleet to sneak over to the Aleutians to assault enemy warships and evacuate all the remaining men on Kiska in a single go. To be blunt, it was a dumb idea. The American warships were equipped with radar that would pick up any surface ships with ease despite any type of fog. But what was about to occur can only be described as a spectacular and bizarre event. Rear Admiral Kimura, the victor of the Battle of the Bismarck Sea, would lead a force, and he had at his disposal Destroyer Squadron No. 1, consisting of Yugumo, Kazagumo, Asagumo, Akigumo, Uzugumo, Ibiki, which is the same name as one of my favorite whiskeys from Japan, by the way, Shimikaze, Samidare, Nayanami, Wakabe, Hatsushumo, and light cruisers Abukuma and Kiso. In close support of these was also a covering force consisting of the heavy cruisers Nachi, Maya, light cruiser Tama, and destroyers Nokaze and Namikaze. The large convoy force departed from Paramashiro on July the 7th, with Takeo's 1st Submarine Squadron performing reconnaissance. The covering force departed Paramashiro on July the 10th, and by July the 12th, the fleet was around 500 miles south of Kiska. When they took up this assembly position, the sailors were in despair to see the fog was quite low. While it did not matter for warships with radar, Kimura knew full well what Allied aircraft could do to his forces if they were not better concealed. Thus, he elected to wait until the fog reappeared to cover his force. But the weather did not change. The skies remained clear, forcing him to head back on July the 15th. Meanwhile, over on Kiska, Rear Admiral Manzo was frantically ordering his troops to lay out a road from the underground base to the harbor piers to help facilitate the impending evacuation. All of the Japanese on Kiska felt an impending doom was placed upon them. If the Americans landed first, it was all but over. Luckily, Japanese weather stations reported a dense fog would emerge over Kiska by July the 25th. And unlike here in Montreal, Canada, I guess these weather reporters are accurate. Kimura once again departed Paramashiro on July the 22nd, accompanied by Admiral Kawase aboard the cruiser Tama. Yet a few days prior, on July the 19th, Admiral Kincaid had ordered Admiral Giffen to bombard Kiska yet again. This time, Giffen took a two-pronged naval attack force consisting of battleships Mississippi and Idaho, cruisers Portland and Wichita, San Francisco, Louisville, Santa Fe, and destroyers Abner Reed, Farragut, Monaghan, Perry, Alwyn, Batch, Hughes, Morris, and Mustin. Giffen's force reached Kiska on July the 22nd, and his ship smashed the island with 424,000 pounds of high-explosive shells. Just an hour later, a PBY suddenly detected with her radar 7 radar pips southwest of Attu. The PBY maintained contact for around 6 hours before low fuel forced her to return to base. These radar pips alarmed Admiral Kincaid because they were being reported in conjunction with a massive increase in Japanese radioactivity on Kiska. Kincaid believed a major Japanese fleet had just entered the Aleutian waters, most likely a reinforcement convoy. Kincaid immediately ordered Rear Admirals Giffen and Griffin to intercept the suspected enemy. However, by doing this, he had also done something extremely favorable to the Japanese. He had left Kiska Harbor open and completely unguarded. Kincaid dispatched a quartet of PT boats to try and provide a makeshift blockade, but the terrible weather forced the smaller vessels to return to port, as trying to dash over to Kiska would probably see them all sunk. While all of this was occurring, Kimura's ships were traveling through the dense fog separately. The fog prevented the Americans from intercepting them initially, and having failed to make contact with the enemy, Kincaid became nervous the Japanese might escape the blockade and ordered the force to return to Kiska at maximum speed by July the 25th. The American ships dutifully turned back while Kincaid sent the oiler Pecos out to meet them for refueling. By dusk of the 25th, the American ships were around 90 miles from Kiska, when the fog had all but disappeared, showing a cloudless sky. Kimura's vessels, seeing their fog betray them yet again, all reunited as a single force, now bearing 400 miles south of the American warships. At precisely 12:43 a.m. on July the 26th, the American warships picked up 7 strong radar pips around 15 miles northeast. It was Mississippi's SG radar that first picked them up. The American destroyers were actually unable to detect any pips on their radar due to the curvature of the ocean's surface at such a distance. The New Mexico, Portland, San Francisco, and Wichita began picking up the same radar pips. The radar pips zigzagged across the sea surface, changing direction in much the same way ships attempting to evade detection might do. The ships were being detected, all at different angles, verifying to the Americans there were indeed physical presences of some kind occupying definite points in space. On top of this, the immobile radar signature of Kiska's volcano at a range of 78 miles appeared clearly the entire time, verifying the validity of the pips moving with a fixed landmark. The radar pips converged 22,000 yards ahead of the Americans, forcing them to spring into action. Admiral Giffen called for the entire fleet to turn left to intercept the pips on their southerly heading, and in the hopes of foiling a possible torpedo attack. All of the American ships turned their guns to fire salvos into the night. Great flame lances stabbed into the darkness as destroyers launched volleys of torpedoes and radar plotters frantically calculated salvo corrections. For 67 minutes, the Americans tracked the seven radar pips firing wildly at them. At 1:30 a.m., the Mississippi's log recorded zigzags and a 20-degree course change, but not a single sailor saw an enemy ship. Cruisers San Francisco and Santa Fe registered shell splashes, but never an enemy target. 75 miles over on Kiska, the Japanese were watching a spectacle. From their viewpoint, it was like a nighttime light show over the horizon. By 2:22 a.m., the radar pips thinned, faded, and then vanished completely. During the morning, surface ships and aircraft fanned out looking for wreckage, ships, floating papers, oil slick, anything to indicate something was even out there. The American warships reported not a single instance of return fire. It was as if they faced ghosts. With a lack of fuel and ammunition, the U.S. ships began refueling on the 28th and they resumed their naval blockade of Kiska. And all of that, my friends, was famously to become known as the Battle of the Pips, which left the U.S. Navy with a mystery that remains pretty much unsolved to this very day. The radar equipment was operating at times where there was a cloudless night with no fog, zero reasons for false radar echoes. An Aleutian crab fishing captain named Captain George Fulton may have solved this mystery back in 1991. When he had managed to duplicate the radar signatures observed during the Battle of the Pips by using his radar on a natural phenomenon common to the area. He presented his findings to the Alaska War Symposium in 1993 in a letter. Here is part of it. I duplicated the Battle of the Pips using color radar. Sure enough, there were blips on the tube and their density changed from red to orange to yellow and finally to black, providing an exact replication of the Battle of the Pips. What you describe fits the exact pattern of dense flocks of mutton birds or dusky shearwaters. As mutton birds fly, they veer left and right. This accounts for the zigzagging that was reported on the radar logs. Captain Fulton further went on to say how these huge flocks continue until they see large schools of fish, such as pollack. When the birds see them, they begin landing on the sea surface, then they dive for their prey. This little maneuver causes them to vanish from radar screens entirely. In the 1990s, Aleutian fishing crews used this trait to locate large concentrations of pollack, identifying the blips by their zigzagging motion and casting their nets accordingly. So, were the Japanese saved by some shearwater birds? Another answer came from the United States Navy, who officially stated that atmospheric echoes, a sort of phenomena, caused the radar pips. And that explanation has been highly contested ever since. It has also been speculated that the American radar pips were the seven IGN submarines running reconnaissance. But I will add that the Japanese have logs about their submarine actions, and it couldn't have possibly been the submarines. Although I always suspected myself that would be the most likely cause for the radar pips. What we do know is Kimura made it to Kiska on the 28th undetected and unharmed, while the US warships were en route miles back. No American ships were anywhere near Kiska on the 28th. Admiral Kimura pulled the ships into Kiska anchorage and evacuated the entire remaining force on the island, all 5,183 men onto 8 vessels and all within 55 minutes. The Japanese soldiers made sure to spend their last moments on the island setting up a plethora of booby traps. 4 days later, Kimura and Kawase were back in Puramashiro, successfully having evacuated Kiska without firing a single shot. The Americans had no idea the evacuation had even occurred. In the words of one disgruntled American colonel after the Kiska ordeal, "How I hate those bastards, but I've got to give them credit for the most masterly evacuation by any army at any time. And I'm not forgetting Dunkirk." I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that you are still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, The Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. And like I said, if you are a little bit impatient and want to hear more about the Kiska adventure, check out my interview with Brad St. Croix on the experience of Canadians during the Pacific War. And just a reminder, over on my Patreon, which can be found at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, you can listen to exclusive podcasts such as my series on General Kanji Ishiwara, or to premiere later this month, my episode on Responsibility Upon Emperor Hirohito. How much did he know and how much did he do during the war? That one's going to be a very dark episode, by the way. Check it out, it means a lot to me. The drive to Ley and Salamaua rages on New Guinea as the American Navy in the frigid northern seas fought perhaps a ghost ship army. Or perhaps some pesky birds looking for some tasty pollock saved the entire Japanese garrison on the island of Kiska.